As Hurricane Florence makes landfall in North Carolina, parts of Jacksonville are still trying to recover 1 year after Irma. JEA and City Hall file a lawsuit to void an old agreement over a Georgia nuclear plant. And it's a new home for the Florida Times Union, some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. And as we talk about a very busy week in the news, we want you to call our Friday Media Roundtable. Give us a call right now at 549-2937. Then later, cutting the ribbon on the new Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center. Big health news for the First Coast. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly media roundtable as we welcome back to Studio 5 radio host Angela Spears. Good to see you.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. It's Friday. Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
It's good to be here.
And Claire Goforth, who edits Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
Lots to talk about this morning. Everything from a new home for the Times Union, a lawsuit involving JEA and a nuclear power plant, even some new troubles we're hearing about at Florida Coastal School of Law. We'll get into all of that in a moment. But first this morning, it's our top story this Friday. As Hurricane Florence bears down on the Carolinas right now, we here in Florida this week are watching from afar as this week we also marked the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Irma, leaving massive devastation and historic flooding in this city. 1 year later, Jacksonville still has not recovered from the damage Irma left behind. So many people still struggling who lost their homes, their businesses, their cars. All parts of the city were affected. The long-term recovery organization is one of many here in this city that is trying to help people recover. But it's really amazing how a year later, as we look back to what happened with Irma, how tough it's been to bounce back from, and how the city really still is not fully prepared for another devastating storm like that. So as we begin the hour, give us a call with your thoughts. As we make our way through hurricane season, it's 549-2937 to join us, 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or let us know your thoughts on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Claire, let's start with you. The Long-Term Recovery Organization, the United Way, Builders Care are some of the groups helping people a year later. There have been individual volunteer efforts as well. Lots of people like Hope McMath and others just going into neighborhoods and working and doing what they can. Even the United Arab Emirates is sending us money to help us recover from Hurricane Irma, which is simply extraordinary. Hard to believe it was a year ago this week.
It is. And it's I think it's a testament to just how severe the devastation caused by the storm was. I think that a lot of us are wondering, what is the city doing to improve infrastructure so that the next time we get a storm, we are not facing such a long recovery? Because the flooding, while not entirely avoidable, there are ways to mitigate the damage. And we know based on climate modeling and the fact that according to Weather Underground, of the 15 most active hurricane seasons, that's seasons with the most numbers of named storms, 10 of them have occurred since the year 2000. So the truth is we're going to face more storms and maybe more powerful storms. So a lot of us, as we're trying to help our comrades, like people on Ken Knight Drive who have faced a very long road to recovery that continues to present day, are wondering what we're doing to make sure that this isn't the situation every time a hurricane hits our area.
Tim Gibbons.
I mean, just imagine if Florence did hit here, you know, as people are still trying to recover. You look at other Florida cities. I mean, St. Augustine, just down the road, is known for its commitment to trying to be more resilient to both making investment in infrastructures and changing zoning codes and doing things that are designed to deal with this new normal, as Claire said. I mean, basically, this is not a once-in-the-century storms now seem to be cropping up every couple of years. And we have to prepare for that and not just kind of pretend that, this was just one bad year. No, this is the new normal.
Yeah. And, you know, it's striking to watch the Carolinas prepare for Florence and to read in the New York Times that a few years ago, they actually made it illegal to change building codes along the coast and change development practices to allow for the impact of climate change and sea level rise.
Because if you don't do anything, obviously that means it doesn't happen. I mean, so, changing the zoning code is just giving in, really. I mean...
Right. I mean, there seems to be, in many parts of Florida, still this willful refusal to acknowledge the reality that we now live in, which is that more storms are coming. They will be slower, but they will be stronger. We can expect more flooding. We can expect more damage. And we, as a state, collectively, including here in Jacksonville, have not gotten serious about addressing what's coming down the road. We can expect a lot more of this. Angela Spears.
And Melissa, you see certain parts of the city bounce back quicker than other parts of the city, and there's a focus on certain parts of the city. So you're so right with all of that. And it's like looking at, as Claire said, looking at the infrastructure to see what needs to be done, what can be done. I was talking with someone just this week, and she said she had a family member who's still recovering from Matthew from 2 years ago. Was that 2 years, Matthew? You know, it all kind of comes together, but still recovering from that storm, yet alone Irma.
I received tweets about this the other day when we talked about it on Monday. Climate injustice is a term that looks at the way that people in poor communities, people in communities of color, poor people, old people, just the most vulnerable people in a society bear more of the brunt of climate-related impacts, whether it's what we've seen here in Florida, extreme heat in other parts of the world. And that played out right here in Jacksonville. Although everyone was affected and every neighborhood got hit, there are neighborhoods where drainage and infrastructure is still a huge issue, and that this city over decades still has not adequately addressed that problem.
Well, it's not very sexy to improve infrastructure, is it, to improve drainage? You know, you can't attend a ribbon cutting for a new sewer system or a new, you know, stormwater runoff system. It doesn't attract the crowd, or you can't really slap somebody's nameplate on it like you can a new building, for instance. And, you know, and at the same token, when you look at building standards and building code, you have an industry that really is reticent to diminish that bottom line on their end. You know, it's more expensive to change code and to build things that are more resilient to hurricanes. So the builder has in their interest, you know, they're just looking to make their profits. They're in business. And, you know, you have to balance that with the needs of the city to have stable infrastructure so that when we get, you know, not just infrastructure, but stable buildings, so that when we do get a hurricane, as we will, that there is less damage that's long term.
And Deidre Connor of the Long-Term Recovery Organization told WJCT, this is the first time in recent history Jacksonville has needed a long-term recovery effort. Dozens of nonprofits are working on this with the city. And she pointed out that at least $4 million in damage remains around town, particularly affecting the elderly, the disabled, and the low income. So there is a lot of work happening to help these people.
There definitely are. I mean, and the long-term recovery group is great for that purpose. I mean, you look at the First Coast Fund, which was set up, I think, after Matthew, which was a commitment by the private sector and some government money to basically say, you know, we need to help the people affected by this. But I think for a lot of us, for those of us who don't live in neighborhoods who already have poor infrastructure, you end up with the impacts of the storm are passed in a couple weeks, you know, so your power goes out, but you get it back. You might have flooding, but, you know, you have somebody come and repair the water damage and life goes on. We're talking about parts of the city that even when there's not a hurricane, don't have the appropriate infrastructure. They don't have sidewalks. They don't have storm drains.
Right.
They don't have the things that you need to have a functioning neighborhood.
You know, it was remarkable after Irma hit, Angela, that I remember the Tampa Bay Times did a big story on how flat-footed Jacksonville was in getting hit with this level of flooding. And they interviewed some people up along, I think, the Rebalt River or the Trout River. Those neighborhoods get flooded every single time. They interviewed a guy who knew that his home was going to be destroyed, and he had spent years by himself digging this huge trench around his home, literally going out every day like Tim Robbins in The Shawshank Redemption and digging a little bit in his backyard and in his front yard and making a berm of dirt, a huge wall of dirt around his property. And he spent years doing this. And because he knew it was the only way his home would make it if another big storm came along. Sure enough, Irma came. Mm-hmm. Every house on that street was flooded, moldy, maybe beyond redemption, except this one guy's house. Because on his own, he had to go out and do this because he knew the infrastructure was not good enough in his neighborhood, a majority African-American North Side neighborhood.
We need to put more pressure, or citizens need to put more pressure on our lawmakers, right, on our city council persons to do something, to pass this. And Melissa, I want to go back to what you said about climate change. That's why it's so important. I think people really need to pay attention to what's going on at the federal level, the changes that are happening in the EPA, you know, all of the regulations that are being rolled back. These are things that we need to pay attention to because it affects us here in Jacksonville. It affects our infrastructure. So it's about holding our lawmakers, the city council persons, accountable for this.
And meanwhile, I just read that, well, I think it was a day or so ago, that gubernatorial candidate Ron DeSantis, while he was saying that he was going to restore the Everglades and stop this, stop the algae blooms, he stopped short of saying that he believed in climate change. So, I mean, that tells you that there is, even at the highest levels, a lot of resistance to just accepting the reality that our climate is changing, regardless of what the cause may be, and we need to start to mitigate for that.
That's the key point that I just find somewhat baffling about the entire climate change, discussion, argument. The idea of, is it man-made? Is it just a cycle we're going through? I don't honestly see what the point is about arguing about that now when we're looking at the impacts of the climate changing. And when the vast majority of the scientific community looks at rising temperatures, rising sea levels, the way the world is changing, and saying, no, this is only liberals believe in climate change. Well, okay, tell that to the conservatives who live in Ponte Vedra. I mean,
it's happening. It's happening.
The water levels are rising.
When the water starts coming in, the politics tend to get pushed aside. For example, in South Florida, you see this astoundingly effective bipartisan coalition of mm-hmm. mayors and city managers and county officials. They've formed the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact, and they are actively working to mitigate against rising waters because Miami is perhaps the most vulnerable city in America to this. The worst models show Miami being half or even three quarters underwater by the middle or by 2050, 2075. No one knows the date, but you know, they're getting sunny day flooding in Miami all the time now. And so once the water's there, people realize once they see it over and over again, they stop arguing and they start mitigating. And so Jacksonville, for whatever reason, has not gotten there yet because the water isn't coming in all the time here.
And we talk about it and we cover it every single time that it happens. And you go back to those same places, the old reliables, back when I was in television, we'd always say, okay, you know, you can go to the McCoy's Creek area, right? There are certain places that you know you can go around town because there will be flooding. You know, they fixed it a little bit downtown by Confederate Park mm-hmm. area, that area. But okay. You know those are the areas. And so why haven't we fixed it?
It's a question we'll keep asking on this program, and we'll keep asking public officials to appear on this program to discuss it.
Well, and that must be fun.
Yes, I'm sure they'll be thrilled. We've had many officials from City Hall over the years, from Public Works and other places, talking about this issue. We've also interviewed scientists from NASA, NOAA, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. They have all gotten religion on climate, and they've started actively planning to protect our infrastructure in this area, particularly our historic monuments down in St. Augustine and other places. At the governmental level in those agencies, they're working on this. So that's just something we need to point out as well. Okay, well, if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday roundtable. As we talk about the biggest stories of the week, you can give us a call, add your voice to the conversation at 549-2937. And another headline that caught our eye this week, Jacksonville's utility, JEA, and City Hall. Well, they filed a lawsuit Tuesday, and it seeks to void a controversial agreement that's a decade old, obligating all of us local ratepayers to help build and eventually buy power from two planned nuclear reactors in Georgia. This lawsuit is a big escalation in a fight over the future of the only active nuclear power project in the U.S. This story from the Florida Times-Union, our news partner, and they're reporting the Municipal Electric Authority of Georgia, one of the co-owners of the Plant Vogtle nuclear project, also filed a federal lawsuit against JEA Tuesday. So lawsuits are flying back and forth here. And up in Georgia, they're accusing JEA of having a clear intent to breach its contract and abandon its obligations. JEA really wants out of this purchase power agreement that it signed back in 2008 because the expansion of nuclear up in Georgia has seen cost overruns, delays. This is a big problem for JEA, and it's something every ratepayer needs to know more about. What are your questions and comments? Call us up at 549-2937. Tim Gibbons, this has been going on for some time, but now it seems the stakes have raised.
It has. In part, the entire sale conversation around JEA, I think, really brought it into public consciousness of just this horrible, horrible deal that JEA entered into. What I find fascinating about this, always looking at lawsuits when someone says the phrase of a clear intent to breach its contract and abandon its obligation. Yeah, JEA is pretty upfront about that. It wants to abandon its obligations. It's arguing that it shouldn't, that its board did not have the authority to enter into those obligations. But from the standpoint of those building the power plant, they were basing everything they were doing on the fact that JEA had signed this contract. And JEA's argument is interesting that they shouldn't have done that.
It speaks to, when you look at the energy industry and as utilities struggle with their portfolio of energy mix as they try to wean off fossil fuels, going more into nuclear has upsides and downsides. And JEA is seeing that like all the other major utilities.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we can say for nuclear energy is that it would not impact climate change. So there are positives to it. I do find the argument that JEA is making, and let's concede that my husband is an employee of JEA, but I find it interesting because they're suing a Georgia entity in Florida court based on Florida law. So we have a jurisdictional issue here. Does Florida's law and do the Florida courts have jurisdiction to alter a contract that was formed with this Georgian entity? I don't know that that is a very strong argument. It is certainly maybe what their lawyers are telling them is the best argument. Although, really, from what I'm seeing from the outside looking in and not being familiar with the terms of these lawsuits, I would say that negligence may be the best argument because it's the construction overrun costs that are really at the root of this. So if they're really going to have a chance of success, they may want to look at those grounds. However, the problem becomes that the company that they say responsible for the overruns, Westinghouse, filed for bankruptcy in March 2017. So there's really nothing to get from them, although you could maybe attack the parent company, Toshiba. But then again, we're talking about a much more complicated lawsuit that could drag on for many years.
There was a period in Jaxamo's history where it seemed, I'm not saying they got bad legal advice, but there were several deals that they entered into that seemed to not have the type of due diligence or type of contract review that one would hope for. And those chickens are now coming home to roost. And we've seen it with other projects over the years where the city would enter into a contract and then years later, maybe just a few years later, and in some cases go, oh, holy crap, that's not what we thought was going to happen. And a lot of times it's when you have a legal team fighting against a very dedicated, real estate team or energy team who really knows what they're doing. And it sometimes looks like corners got cut.
And that was my question, going over the story, doing the research on it. My question was, how did this happen? If the board did not have the authority to do so, how did the lawyers with JEA, with the city, how did we let that get through if they did not have the authority and the oversight to have that?
I think that's why there's even national coverage of this whole flap in the Financial Times and other outlets where I've seen it being covered.
Oh, this is huge in the energy sector. I mean, it's the same sort of coverage that the potential JEA sale got, where JEA is a major utility. And if you follow the energy sector, it does make headlines.
Is this why we wanted to sell JEA?
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Chris in Avondale. Hi,
the
Chris.
Mayor.
Hi, Chris. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to change topics on you, but I was going back to the flooding issue. And what makes me very curious is, why is it that Lenny Curry is spending so much time and money worrying about the Hart Bridge off ramps, trying to tear those down for the money that he's getting from the state, rather than looking at some of these serious infrastructure problems that we've had for years and years? And, and also I look at, Trump doing the tariffs, and then he's, punished the farmers. But so he says, oh, well, here, have, $12 million for that. this money seems to be so easily thrown around for garbage, but it doesn't seem to be working well for things that we know we actually need. And just like I heard one of your people say, you know, yes, opening a new sewer plant is not exciting, but it would be exciting if the people that I watch digging their belongings out of garages in chest deep water would probably appreciate.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Governing is choosing. How many times have we said that on this program? And with a limited pool of dollars, our elected officials make choices. And so, you know, he brought up the Hart Bridge ramps. That's a priority not only for City Hall, but also Shad Khan, who wants to develop the whole area around the football stadium. It's my understanding that there was a town hall about that Tuesday night, that some city council members and some staff of the mayor's came out and talked to residents about why they want to pull down those ramps. And so, you know, there's an argument to be made for pulling them down if you think it's important to build up that sports complex and bring in more money to the city that way. But at the same time, there's a valid concern from people in this city who feel that not enough money is being spent on critical needs like infrastructure.
As we look at the anniversary of consolidation, I think this is has to be acknowledged as one of the perhaps unintended consequences of it, that we don't have smaller communities who would be going to the state, going to the federal government, fighting for dollars to fix their community. We end up with, you know, Jacksonville writ large getting funding for the projects that the Jacksonville Power Structure thinks is needed. And maybe they are. Oftentimes, I think they indeed are. But there's only so many asks you can have out, sort of thing. And if the attention is focused on the shipyards, it means it's not being focused on the northwest side.
And you have this problem all the time with people saying, okay, you're focusing on downtown way too much. But if we want people to come into the city, right, we want people, we want attractions, then you've got to build up that one area. But yeah, it's at the sacrifice, Melissa, of another part of town.
And from the business standpoint, I mean, the argument is you bring people into the shipyards, you generate those bed tax dollars, you generate,
and then you can do things for the,
and then you can, right. I mean, a bigger mm-hmm. city that has more revenue can do more for the poorer parts of the city. So you kind of have to prioritize making the money before you spend it.
But we've been listening to that same argument for years and years and years, and yet very True. Little changes to help these poorer neighborhoods. I mean, we want a sports complex center, right? But we need infrastructure. So when you look at the city budget, it certainly is a reflection of the values of our city. And are the values of our city giving away millions and millions of dollars to people like Shad Khan, who arguably do not need that money?
Let's take one more call on this. It is Michelle in Mandarin, and I think she's just getting into the queue. Hey, Michelle, it's Melissa. You're on the air. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi. I said, I've been working in the utility and energy space for the better part of 10 years, and Westinghouse actually went bankrupt because of another nuclear plant in South Carolina that had billions of dollars in cost overruns. And to put a broader perspective on it, I would really like to see a fraction of the cost of that dollar figure, millions, much less billions, invested in renewables R&D and battery storage R&D to actually make that, you know, more viable on a commercial scale. And it upsets me that I feel like it's a lack of leadership, what I like to call middle-aged white man short-sighted syndrome. Just taking, you know, the tact that they would rather sink tons and tons of money into nuclear rather than invest in renewables.
Thanks for that, Michelle.
Middle-aged white man short-sighted syndrome. That's classic right there.
It's a good friend. You need to
Sorry,
you know, snap
Tim
your
Gibbons.
Acronym. Yeah,
you're
going
to have to write that one down. Yeah, use that one in your next article.
I'm a middle-aged white guy who tries not to be short-sighted. Nuclear is absolutely has been proven to be a good part of a low carbon footprint sort of power production. The problem is we're not building nuclear plants anymore. And so, you know, trying to do it, each one's a one-off, and the amount of cost overruns, you know, always quickly mount. I will say that there are businesses putting billions into renewable research. I mean, the battery space is actually a fascinating one right now, because that is the next frontier. If we're going to use renewables to the level that we should, we need better energy storage.
And by the way, for that caller, I hear you on that middle-aged white man short-sighted syndrome. We've all been there, Michelle. We've all been there. Sorry, Tim. I don't mean you, Tim.
I'm not arguing.
Okay. Also, a quick note. The Florida Times-Union will be moving into the Wells Fargo Center in downtown Jacksonville. The move expected to be completed during the first quarter of next year. It's really remarkable to note that the Times Union has been at its current address, 1 Riverside Avenue, for more than 50 years. But with the changes in the newspaper industry, they need far less square footage. And so the TU moving into the Wells Fargo building.
I just want to say, and probably Folio might feel the same way as newspapers who have been based in downtown for a long time, we do welcome the city's newspaper to its actual urban core to, you know, focus on some of the issues here. It's nice to see them coming to the area.
Certainly. And, you know, I realize that the Jacksonville Business Journal, Folio Weekly, Daily Record, and soon to be the Florida Times Union will all be within like about a 4-block area of downtown, which I think we should all start just calling Print Press Row.
We need like a good newspaper bar there.
We need a name of a district name for this little area of downtown.
I was talking with someone just recently about this, and this is the total flip side of it. Total flip side of what she was saying. She said she feels this is like another blow to journalism because, you know, the newspaper had its own site for so long. Remember, it was able to produce and print its own paper. Mm-hmm. Now it has to go to Gainesville to do this. Now it's moving away from its own independent source and moving into another building. And I said, that's a great concept. She's like, you know, that's another hit on the free press. It was an interesting thought, and I said that's a valid point.
I think it's more a symptom that maybe than a cause, but yeah, it's a clear demonstration of just, you know, there's not as many bodies there. They don't produce as much stuff. Their design's outsourced. I mean, it's a changing world.
Definitely.
Now, and I just encourage everyone, subscribe to the Times Union. We need the Times Union. We need the Business Journal. We need Folio. We need free and robust press in every city in America, bringing information to the community. So my 2 cents there. Also this week, the American Bar Association denied Florida Coastal School of Law's appeal after the school was found not in compliance with accreditation standards. Those findings were published in October and confirmed in March by the ABA Accreditation Committee. This is from the Jacksonville Daily Record. So what is the fate of Florida Coastal School of Law in Jacksonville?
You know, as an alum of Florida Coastal School of Law, 10 years this year, I can say from personal experience, I've received an excellent education there, which enabled me to pass the bar in the first go-round. But, you know, what ABA is saying is really they're saying that Florida Coastal School of Law is admitting students who have no chance of passing the bar. And they're also saying that Florida Coastal is not providing a program that effectively trains people to pass the bar. And Florida Coastal School of Law is saying that ABA is biased against for-profit law schools, and their parent company, InfoLaw, which also owns a couple of other law schools, is having some severe issues with this. The Arizona school is not having classes this fall. The Charlotte school actually closed after losing its accreditation based on these very same arguments.
Well, the ABA is saying that Florida Coastal has to do a number of things to, I guess, keep their doors open. They have to bring the school into compliance. They have to distribute information relating to bar exam pass rates, basically prove that they deserve to stay open per the bar.
If I recall correctly, the school was it the first for-profit law school? Or it was one of the first. And
it was one of the first.
It definitely, I don't know if bias claims are accurate, but it definitely, it basically helped create this industry. And you always have that disruption issue when a new player comes in. Maybe it's not doing everything the same way that older players did, but do you treat it the exact same way? You know, the Bar Association obviously feels you should.
Right. Well, finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida, I love this one. Only in Florida do drug suspects say the wind blew the cocaine into their purse. That happens to all of us.
That's a good one.
That's why they call it blow.
Oh.
You have to give points for creativity to Kenesia Posey of Fort Pierce. An officer searched her car after smelling marijuana and found cocaine and marijuana in separate bags in her purse. When asked about the drugs, Kenesia said, "Well, it's a windy day. It must have flown through the window and into my bag here."
Wow.
That's a creative excuse.
At least they weren't mixed, I guess. I mean,
Posey is charged with cocaine possession. Only in Florida do lawn ninjas just take those riding lawnmowers from the store that they have not paid for and ride off with them. an unidentified middle-aged white man
who is short-term thinking.
With short-term thinking in Seminole, decided to drive off with a $2,600 Toro mower the other day after stealing it from Dudeness Mowers. We here at Only in Florida have the question, are these vehicles street legal?
And what's the were the cops chasing him in a scooter or something?
How did they exactly. And because the police are still looking for him, right?
Yeah, unidentified.
They can go kind of fast.
Maybe it was a windy day, so he was moving. He was moving faster.
And maybe he's the one who had the cocaine and blew into the lady's purse.
Anyway, he's the king of the hill in Seminole. A little music for everyone who loved that show. And thank you, Claire Goforth, Tim Gibbons, and Angela Spears. We'll be right back. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Melissa. Have a good one.
Do you listen to WJCT? Every hour? Every day? Imagine if you gave a dollar every time you tuned in to WJCT. What would that add up to? Okay, now get out your wallet and your phone. Go ahead, I'll wait. Now call 353-9528 and make a donation in support of the programs you count on.
On the next Jazz Night in America, we pay tribute to the late NEA jazz master, pianist Randy Weston. In conversation at his home in Brooklyn.
So I had Panamanian father and a Virginia mama. I'm born in Brooklyn. So the culturally, it was very rich.
And in concert in Panama City. I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street Radio. This week I traveled to Freedom, Maine to chat with Aaron French, chef and founder of The Lost Kitchen, one of the most exclusive restaurants in America. Also on this week's show, Maura Judkiss on the wild, wild world of pumpkin spice. And Dr. Aaron Carroll answers the question, should we avoid high-mercury fish? Coming up this week on Milk Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday morning at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's very exciting health news for the First Coast. Cancer patients and their families have enhanced access to nationally renowned cutting-edge treatment as the Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center opens its new facility in San Marco this week. This is a 184,330,000 square foot outpatient facility, and it's going to be a regional and national hub for cancer care. Everything from physician appointments to imaging, radiation, and infusion therapy, all under one roof in a beautiful environment designed to promote healing. Now, the facility design reflects this multidisciplinary clinic model established by the renowned MD Anderson Cancer Center. It's one of the nation's leading cancer centers, and they partnered with Baptist Health in 2014 to bring this cutting-edge care here to Northeast Florida. It's exciting news. Here with more, we're pleased to welcome Hugh Green, CEO of Baptist Health, Dr. Peter Pisters. He is president of the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, and Dr. Bill Putnam, medical director, Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center. Gentlemen, good morning and congratulations. Good to have you on the
show.
Thank
you. It's always good to be here.
Great to be with you, Melissa.
Hugh Green, let's begin with you. You've been working on this for years, and we've been watching the building go up in San Marco. It's so exciting now to have the building finally open. Very, very big deal for Jacksonville.
It really is. It's an exciting moment for us, and this building is quite unique, and I really hope people have the opportunity to see it, particularly during the public open house this Saturday. I always want to emphasize, though, that the building is beautiful. It is a healing environment. But most importantly is what goes on inside that building in terms of the care for cancer patients. This is about caring for people who have cancer and their families.
Sure. And there's amazing care in Jacksonville already. But this, you know, this takes things to a new level. Dr. Peter Pisters, you are president of UT's MD Anderson Cancer Center. people that know anything about cancer treatment in America know about this facility in Houston. And so tell us a little bit more about why the protocol is so renowned and why you've seen the success that you have over the years.
Well, good morning, Melissa. It's great to be here and to be in Jacksonville to celebrate. I think when we reflect upon the success of our organization and our number one status nationwide, much of that is really driven by the principles of team-based clinical care that really are the hallmark of how we deliver comprehensive cancer care for patients.
Team-based care, and that's not necessarily the old-fashioned way of doing it. You're doing things in a new way, correct?
That's right. It really involves, for the cancer patient, making sure that the diagnosis is correct. In certain types of cancers, it means assigning a molecular subtype. It means making sure that we're really clear for an individual patient whether their tumor is localized or whether or not it has spread, and then gathering a team around the patient, thinking about the holistic needs of the patient to formulate treatment plans.
And Bill Putnam, your MD, medical director for Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center. This is great news, not only for people all over Florida and the Southeast, but also for people right here in town that you know, they now have this option for treatment that they didn't have before.
Yes, this really provides a center where patients and families can get the care that they need under one roof. We have medical oncology, radiation oncology, surgery, as well as all the support services, clinical nutrition, genetic counseling, spiritual care. These things are so important for the holistic approach to the patient, you know, but grounded on the significant science that we have to apply for the cancer patient's care.
And there are all kinds of cancers, all kinds of ways to get sick, but what are some advancements in the field that you can share with us that you're applying at this new facility?
Well, we have, as Peter mentioned, this integrated team approach, which really provides the most consistent outcomes for any cancer patient. And in so doing, we're applying the new therapies, immunotherapy, intensity modulated radiation therapy, minimally invasive surgery, enhanced recovery where we can practically eliminate the need for narcotics. And we can do this for every patient, because every patient is seen by a conference. And we can do this in a way that really meets their needs.
That's exciting, Hugh. You know, and we've heard a lot in particular about immunotherapy and how, I mean, I've known lots of people who have traveled out of state to have that therapy. Now they can stay here and benefit from these advancements. It's exciting.
That's right, Melissa. And, you know, one of the things that I've tried to stress is people have tried to understand this relationship. It really is the largest health system in Jacksonville and a very integrated relationship with the leading cancer center in the country. And when you said they can stay right at home, we are replicating the model of care, using the protocols, participating in research that occurs in Houston right here. So it prevents people from having to leave Northeast Florida for the most advanced care to achieve the very best outcomes.
There's a new headline that just crossed this morning. Cancer is expected to kill more than 9 people around the world this year alone. The World Health Organization's cancer research arm released its report Wednesday. 18 million new cases this year, 9 million deaths. The good news is that about half of those people will survive. And you know, this increase, they say, is attributed to everything from population growth to aging. Also, individuals not doing enough to reduce their chance of getting sick. So wellness is a big part of what we all need to be talking about, too, isn't it, Doctor? Taking better care of ourselves. And the healthcare industry, I've talked to Hugh about this a lot over the years, has really put much more emphasis on that than it used to. And that's good.
You're absolutely right, Melissa. One of the great things about this partnership really is our longstanding commitment to cancer prevention. In Houston, we've had a decades-long focus on the science of prevention and on what we call implementation science. How do we take our innovative approaches to preventing cancer and scale them up to populations? When we think about what that means for people here in Jacksonville, it really means the opportunity for us to bring key prevention strategies and to deploy them across the entire population, mm-hmm. reducing the risk for young people in the Jacksonville area to develop cancer in the future, and helping to increase the awareness of a variety of strategies that we can all use as individuals to protect ourselves.
And basic common sense things like not smoking, moderate alcohol consumption, diet and exercise. If more people would just take better care of themselves, there'd be less need for such a beautiful facility. You know, Dr. Putnam, I saw just the other day that after years of decline in consumption of young people using tobacco, that's a worry again for medical professionals because more young people now are vaping. So it seems every time we make progress, we take a step back.
By the way, Melissa, I want to tell you, you're asking the right guy.
Yeah.
He is a lung cancer surgeon.
There you go.
I'm a cardiothoracic surgeon with a focus on lung cancer and other chest cancers, and have treated patients with lung cancer for 3 decades. Education is certainly an important part of it for smoking cessation, but also setting up the social expectations as well, equally important. And for so many people, many of whom have stopped smoking already, who have a smoking history, we have other screening techniques such as lung cancer screening to identify lung cancers at the earliest stage, much like mammography for women's health or
right.
colonoscopy. So these techniques are shown to be effective and can save lives.
And the new research from World Health Organization and the UN does note that lung cancer kills the most people worldwide, followed by breast cancer in women and then colorectal cancer. This is interesting to note, too. More than half of all cancer deaths this year will occur in Asia, home to 60% of the world's population. And of course, I would expect that some of those patients will be traveling here to be treated to Jacksonville because of this new facility.
But the thing we also should emphasize about that is that MD Anderson in Houston actually does have an international presence. And so they really are involved. And now we're part of that network treating people around the world. And Dr. Pishman may want to comment on that.
Certainly. We do have significant international programming, including relationships that really exist between our organization and governments, where the focus really is on developing cancer prevention strategies and cancer control approaches for entire countries.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of experience in the international arena, in addition to the facilities that we have in Istanbul, in Madrid, and in Brazil.
Truly global. And as we continue talking about the big news in Jacksonville this week, the opening of the Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center, in a moment, we're going to hear a little bit more about the building's construction. It's a very beautiful building. You can actually come out and see it this weekend. We're going to tell you about that, an open house coming up, and more. So keep listening as we talk with the leaders of Baptist MD Anderson. Back in a moment.
Financial support keeps WJCT on air and online. Help us keep it pledge-free by making a donation today at 353-9528 or at wjct.org/radio. Thank you.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. A company's cell phone policy can protect your employees and your bottom line. Our distracted driving presentation for the workforce can help.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Here at WJCT, we're working hard to fundraise without interrupting the programs you love. So if you haven't donated yet, consider this. If the first thing you do in the morning is turn to WJCT, or if 89.9 is one of your presets in the car, then the last thing you want is interruptions for fundraising. Help minimize pledge drive by giving now at wjct.org/radio. And thanks.
I'm Ira Flatow. Have you ever competed in a science fair? Well, this week on Science Friday, we take you to the big one, the unique world of Intel's International Science and Engineering Fair. A new film offers a behind-the-scenes view of what happens when a group of high school students from across the globe prepare to compete in the largest science fair competition in the world. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Moonves is moved out. The FDA puts e-cigarette makers on notice, and a former EPA boss eyes a new job as a coal consultant. But this week's news has largely been about a coming storm.
This is going to be, you know, a Mike Tyson punch to the Carolina coast. Neighbors help neighbors in this situation, and let's all be on the team.
The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. We're continuing our discussion with the leadership team from the Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center right now with Hugh Green, CEO of Baptist Health, Dr. Peter Pisters, president of the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center here from Houston, and Dr. Bill Putnam. He's medical director, Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center. And so, Hugh Green, let's talk about this gorgeous new facility. Anyone who's driven around San Marco in the last year or so has seen it going up. And it's always exciting to see a new building have its big grand opening. You're having a big open house tomorrow for the public, I understand. What are people going to see?
Well, this building in itself is a unique building and contributes architecturally to our city. And you can tell that by the use of glass, the angles, the texture, the materials. But most importantly in planning the building, it's important to stress that patients played a major role in helping design what occurs inside the building. And we hope we've created an enhanced healing environment mm-hmm. by the use of light, by making sure the flow with patients is good, waiting spaces, a wonderful chapel that's inside the building as well, a beautiful interior courtyard for people to get away, because people come and stay, particularly when they're getting chemotherapy for mm-hmm. hours. And then also a wonderful art collection, because we're very committed to the role of art in healing. So it is a magnificent facility, but most importantly, designed by and around patients.
Always important. And Dr. Pisters, MD Anderson, I believe, has the most clinical trials going for cancer patients anywhere in the country. So we're going to benefit from that too, right?
Without question. In fact, Melissa, we've got the biggest clinical trials program in the world, and that really enables us through this strategic relationship and partnership with Baptist to really bring those trials here to Jacksonville. And that will really be game-changing for many patients who will have the opportunity to experience tomorrow's treatment today right here in Jacksonville.
That's right. And Dr. Putnam, not only is the San Marco facility opening up, there's a satellite location too down at Baptist South, correct?
Yes, we have some terrific opportunities to meet the needs of our population here in Jacksonville, where the population resides, and having a integrated clinic in the Baptist South area with medical oncology and radiation is very important. We truly have a multidisciplinary team there, just as we have downtown, to meet the needs of our patients.
Excellent. So with all of that said, Hugh Green, there is an opportunity for the public to check all this out. Can you share with us what's going to be happening this weekend?
Well, it really is a public open house, and so we will be prepared to provide tours of the new facility. And the reason that's important to sort of set aside time, because when the center is operating with patients inside, we obviously cannot do that. Mm-hmm. So this is the day we're inviting the public to see the new building.
And they need to come out Saturday, what, 11 a.m.? Is that right?
That's correct. Late morning on Saturday.
Yeah. So come on out tomorrow for the public open house for the grand opening of the new Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center in San Marco. Of course, Baptist Health is a sponsor of this program. And we want to thank all three of you. Hugh Green, he's CEO of Baptist Health. Dr. Peter Pisters. He's president of UT's MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. Bill Putnam is the medical director here in Jacksonville for the new Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center. Big medical news. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us and have a great weekend with all of the excitement.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers as well. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. Our show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chafchik. If you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast. Actually, no, don't catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8. We're running the election-themed program America on the Line. And don't forget to join us at 1 o'clock this afternoon for the Florida Roundup, our look at the biggest stories around the state. 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. This is 89.9, and we'll be back Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.